to Tuscany to visit the hill towns, and we recognize that these are superior environments and that the quality of life is better there. But we come back to America and we continue to make the same foolish decisions and continue to make the misinvestments, and it's amazing. And you see it in another scale in America. There's a whole other class of Americans who will drive 2,500 miles from their small town in Minnesota to go to Walt Disney's Main Street and walk down Main Street there, you know, unmolested by cars, because they really don't let them in, except for the few antique props that they keep around. And, you know, they'll walk around and they'll say, gosh, doesn't it feel good to be on a nice walkable street in a mixed-use, in a simulated mixed-use neighborhood? And then they'll go back home to their small town, and they'll turn Main Street into a six-lane expressway, and they'll cut down all the street trees on Elm Street in order to remove these hazards to motoring, as they're regarded by the departments of transportation. And they'll do everything possible they can to destroy the great relationships between the things in their older towns. And then another year will go by, and they'll go back to Disney World to feel good about America. So it's a pretty kind of pitiful situation.
I got a couple of email requests as well with questions for you. One of them was a person very pleased to see you picking up on Oil Peak just recently. I mean, I know you have before, but your most recent one, I think, on the 6th of March. And so he says, in the light of that, what do you say to a city that is getting ready to build a parking garage in an old downtown as part of rehabbing and enlarging a converted ironworks convention center?
Every city and town, large or small in America, believes that it's a good idea to build parking lots and parking structures, multiple level, right now. And given the cognitive dissonance that exists now in our culture, you know, the mental static in our collective consciousness, it's almost impossible to persuade people that parking structures are a bad idea, because they regard parking structures as a necessary accessory to the rehabilitation of their downtowns. To some extent, it's understandable if you were to believe that the current conditions would continue indefinitely. And I don't try to persuade people not to do it, because I think it's a futile thing to do. You can't persuade them not to do it. I personally don't think that we're going to be using cars 10 or 20 years from now the way we've been accustomed to using them in the past. I think the role of the automobile in our life is going to be greatly diminished. And I regard it as another form of misinvestment to make accommodation for them, especially at that scale. That said, I think right now about the best thing that you can do is to try to talk to people into creating parking structures that can be reused adaptively for something else 10, 20, 30 years down the line. Now, I don't even know if that's possible. A structure that big generally has to have a light well in the center just to, you know, to create apartments in it. But one of the things they can think about doing is designing them so that in the future there can be a light well in the center of the block and create ceilings that will be high enough in the future to accommodate the pipes and things that have to go up in the, you know, the 12 or 24 inches above the ceiling, which means more than an 8-foot deck. And that's, to my way of thinking, about the best you can do right now for that kind of thinking that's going on. Look, you know, I live in a town that has built one parking deck in the last several years and is planning two more. And I'm in the middle of this argument all the time. And I've told people, I said, you know, don't expect the future of this town to be about parking. It ain't going to be about parking, because it ain't going to be about driving as much as it has been. But they're really, their eyes glaze over when you say that, and they simply don't believe it. So it's really more a question of whether you can persuade them to put up buildings that can be used for something else in the future when their disutility as parking structures becomes evident.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, and you brought up the don't believe it problem, which is,
yeah.
I was talking to Colin Campbell about in the light of recent interviews with journalists, and you can lay out certain facts, and they may be disputed as facts, but somehow there's a kind of thing beyond disputing the facts. There's a simple, I just don't believe it. You know, it doesn't fit with anything that I know.
Well, absolutely, and this has been part of my mode of operation for the last 10 years, you know, in the lecture circuit, is that one of the things I refuse to do is engage in a lot of exercises in statistical analysis. Suburbia was largely built on the basis of statistical analysis. That's one of the problems with it. It wasn't based on human neurological needs. It wasn't based on artistry. It was based on things like highway geometries and of measuring volumes of traffic and things that have no relation to whether a place is worth living in or not, finally. and the product of a human habitat based on statistical analysis ends up being a place that's not worth living in and not worth caring about. This, incidentally, is now one of the salient problems that faces America, is that having constructed 27,000 odd places now that are not worth caring about, we may find ourselves living in a country that's not worth defending. That ends up being a very deep and persistent cultural problem that we're going to grapple with for a long time to come. It's hard for me to imagine a lot of those young kids who are in the army who are now going to be shipped over to the desert to engage in combat and probably get wounded. And I wonder how they're going to feel when they're lying in the desert sands there with their blood leaving their body. What is their image of their hometown going to be like, you know? If they're from some place like the suburban wasteland between Dallas and Fort Worth, what's their final memory of their hometown? Of a curb cut between the Chuck E. Cheese and the car wash? You know, that's not good enough. That's not a good enough reason to give your life for your country. And so, you know, that's one of the other, you know, unexpected, unanticipated consequences of doing what we did. You spend half a century creating a land full of places that aren't worth caring for, and you end up with a country that's not worth defending. And it's a tragic, tragic outcome, isn't it?
And how these things relate to wider issues.
For America, it's really a question of how we are going to carry on civilization. How we're going to remain civilized in the face of this catastrophe of losing the motive power behind our living arrangement.
Another chap said, I have read all Mr. Kunstler's books, and I'm a regular for his eyesore of the month. He lives in my neck of the woods, and his penchant for seeing the sad state of architecture and community keeps me coming back. I would like to ask him what he thinks the impact will be on small towns and villages of the coming fossil fuel peak, and does he think it will ultimately create a drive back to those types of living situations or to something different, i.e. rural, urban, so forth?
Well, yes. In fact, my next book is going to be about this and is largely concerned with the tremendous project of downscaling all of the activities of American life and recondensing our living arrangements into coherent towns and villages and neighborhoods. I'm not quite as sanguine about the big cities of America. You know, many of them actually are already cratered. If you go back to central Detroit now, you will find wildflowers growing in many of the what used to be immense neighborhoods of houses in the center of Detroit. Same thing with St. Louis. Same thing with many, many great industrial cities in the Midwest. I think that the small towns and small cities probably offer much more hope. I think that the story of the 21st century is going to be about the relocalization of American life, the tremendous need to reconstruct local networks of economic interdependence, including the occupational niches and social roles that went with them, which were systematically destroyed by the kind of cheap oil behavior that spawned activities like Walmart and all of its imitators. You know, it's a funny thing about Walmart. I've seen this all over the country for the last 10 years where, you know, I've been brought into various local battles over Walmart. But, you know, Americans almost universally greeted this kind of thing with open arms. And the whole idea was, fabulous, we will save $7 on a hair dryer and that will make our life perfect. You know, what they didn't reckon on was that in the process of saving $7 for a hair dryer, they would throw in the garbage $100,000 of their civic life for each $7 that they saved on a hair dryer. And the net effect has been the almost complete disassembly of local networks and local economies and the complete destruction of the civic life of our country and of the social systems that took care of that civic life. You know, the people who used to conduct retail commerce in America formed the middle class of most of our towns and cities. They were the ones who also happened to be the caretakers of our civic institutions. They sat on the school boards and the library boards, you know, and you remove this class of people, not just an individual, but a whole class of people, you're basically throwing your culture in the garbage. The destruction has been so enormous and ought to have been so vivid, because anybody can visit an American small town almost anywhere in America and see nothing but empty storefronts, delaminating buildings, and just tremendous physical decay and dereliction. So that part of it ought to be self-evident, you know, not to mention the loss of jobs, the loss of rich networks of social interaction, interdependence, mutual care, you know, all of these things. this is the great job that faces us now, is restoring those networks and restoring the social roles that went with them. I don't know if we're up to it, but we're going to have to do it whether we like it or not. You know, that gets back sort of to the whole market issue of, well, you know, Americans like suburbia, therefore it must be good. Well, you know, life doesn't work that way. Actually, history and destiny and fate have plans for us. And sometimes we have to do things whether we like it or not. And this is what America really has to do. This is its assignment. Along with this, of course, comes the tremendous task of restoring our food production and farming and agriculture, because along with the end of suburbia, we're going to be experiencing the end of industrial food production, you know, and the 3,000-mile Caesar salad, which epitomizes it. This has tremendous implications for the kind of towns that we have, the kind of value-added manufacturing activities that will go on inside of them, and the kind of jobs and occupations that people will have. You know, I happen to believe that we may actually live to see the birth of a new social class in this country, the rebirth of the American agricultural laborer. It might not be a great life, you know, it may be a very harsh life. But I think we're going to see it, because a lot of our food raising, I think, is going to have to be much more labor-intensive in the future. Where I live, we still have quite a bit of intact agricultural landscape that can be put back into service. But there are a lot of other places in America that have been very, very severely damaged and paved over, and I'm not quite sure what's going to happen with them.
That leads me to mention, since more news came in today, that I believe all the anhydrous ammonia production plants in Minnesota, I read today, have been shut down for lack of natural gas, and natural gas is 80% of the price of fertilizer, which, you know, is very closely related to ammonia. And that leads me to mention, do you think the natural gas problem, some people call it a natural gas crunch, do you think that will wake Americans up to a greater hydrocarbon problem?
Well, you know, something is capable of waking Americans up. We may be sleepwalking into the future. You know, we may have gone into kind of a coma, but we're not dead. You know, I think it will take what I call a bitch slap upside our heads to wake us up. And I think we're going to get it, and it's going to come in one form or another. You know, we could have an oil crisis tomorrow if some chap walks into Prince Abdullah's bedchamber with a bomb strapped to his belt. That could be the end of our Saudi Arabian imports, and indeed that could be the end of the Sauds and their family and their regime and the beginning of something else in Arabia. And that would change everything. As I said earlier, you know, I lived through the 1973 oil embargo, and that made quite an impression on me because, you know, you saw people's behavior change overnight. You saw people being severely impressed with the power of extrinsic events to change your life. And I remember driving down to New York City to see a girl, you know, when I was 25 years old from 150 miles away in Albany, New York. And I was a newspaper reporter at the time. I had planned this trip to see this girl very, very carefully so that I knew where I might be able to get some gas, you know, on the way back from there. And I was the only person on the New York State Thruway between Albany and the Tappan Zee Bridge. And it was like that science fiction movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still. There were like five cars on going down Second Avenue in Manhattan that night. It was very, very spooky. And I've never seen anything like it since. You know, certainly nothing that we've experienced since except the World Trade Center disaster matched that for sheer shock value. But the difference was that the World Trade Center disaster, although it was seen by everybody, it only happened really in one small place. The oil embargo actually happened all over, and people from California to Boston sat on those lines and experienced the trauma and thought very hard about how they were going to make some maybe different decisions about commuting. I, for one, when the oil embargo happened, I had been living in a kind of a rural village about 20 miles away from my job. 2 weeks later, I went in and rented an apartment in downtown Albany, New York. I was working for the newspaper there. So I obviously made a very concrete decision to move and was basically glad I did. But yeah, I think that it's conceivable that that could wake up Americans, and so could a natural gas crisis. Many things could. But the trouble now is, of course, is that our investments in suburbia are orders of magnitude greater than they were even 25 years ago in 1973, and it's going to be much, much harder for Americans to find a pathway out of this. You know, I think the real key to all this is that Americans kind of, in the strange complacency that overtook us in the last 20 years, You know, ever since the North Sea and the Alaskan slope kind of came online and made it possible for us to postpone this reckoning. This strange complacency that overtook us kind of gave us the idea that there's a guaranteed happy ending to every terrible predicament that you find yourself in, that life is sort of like a TV show or a Bruce Willis movie, that there is a happy ending. But in my opinion, the great shock to Americans is going to be to find out that there is no smooth transition between the end of the cheap oil era and whatever follows. In fact, it's going to be very disorderly and very turbulent, and it's going to involve a lot of stress and woe and ruin, and whatever emerges from it is going to emerge from really a great kind of fire of the soul that I think may even match what we went through in the Civil War. And I hope we're able to come out the other end. I'm just young enough, or to put it another way, just not old enough, so that it's conceivable that I could see coming out the other end. And I'm as curious as anybody to see how it turns out.
Hmm. In your book, City in Mind, you gave one of the most graphic portraits of that fine town, Las Vegas, one could imagine. And there's been a vast migration to the Southwest, not just Las Vegas, but huge numbers of places in Arizona, Nevada. That's seen as one of the great places to go in America. It's nice and warm, need a spot of air conditioning when it stays over 100 for 100 days in Dallas and that kind of thing. But how do you think, Las Vegas as being the sort of the most extraordinary example, but how do you think this extraordinary new band of suburbanism really in the Southwest is going to cope not only with the fact that its power and its oil, so the natural gas for its power and other means, and its oil and petrol and gasoline for its autos, and there are not a few water problems in that part of the world. Would you say this is one of the areas of the USA that is going to be hardest hit, and how do you think it's going to cope?
Absolutely. I think the prospects in the Sun Belt are very, very grim.
Even though it has lots of solar?
Yes, that's not going to compensate for the loss of these other fuels, not by a long shot. I actually see many of the Sun Belt places being significantly depopulated over the next 30 years. Some of the populations may be replaced by Mexicans. I also happen to believe that we're going to have much more trouble in our relations with Mexico in the decades ahead, and that to a certain extent, Southern California, Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico are going to become contested territory, and that from a practical standpoint, life is going to become very, very difficult there. They were not places that were really fit to live in anything but a cheap oil economy, because you really need heroic amounts of air conditioning there. They didn't have to lay them out the way they did. I mean, the actual suburban development pattern did not have to happen there, and that would have given them much more of a future. But it didn't work out that way. I went to a conference in Arizona a few years ago, and I stayed in a hotel in Phoenix that was so sprawled out in its own little pod that you actually had to drive from the place where you slept to the place where they gave you breakfast within the resort itself. You know, it was remarkable how auto-dependent it was. Yeah, I regard places like Phoenix and Houston as being hopeless. I make a somewhat of a distinction between what they call the dry Sun Belt and the wet Sun Belt, that is the Southeast and the Southwest. The Southeast, after all, does have some prospects for becoming once again a kind of an agricultural backwater, which I think it will. I mean, there's a reason that there were no big cities in the South, really, until after World War II. Atlanta was smaller than Buffalo, New York, until the 1960s. Orlando was pretty much just a bunch of fruit groves. And Houston was a jerkwater. Phoenix was a jerkwater. These are all tiny little towns until after World War II. They're completely a product of cheap fossil fuels. I think you could say that there is a Hubbard's curve that applies just as appropriately to these cities as it does to oil.
Mm.
So the prospects are poor. I don't mean to be mean about this or cruel about this, but, you know, in Atlanta, you also have to figure in there's an element of culture there. They just sort of crawled out of the mud 23 years ago. And there's an element of culture there that still has a great deal of residual barbarism. And if they are highly stressed, you know, I think that things could get very, very dicey there. You know, there's going to be a lot of, I think, ethnic conflict, and violence does already play kind of a large role in Southern culture. And we could see quite a return to it.
Mm. Do you see conflict arising in America between those who are willing to reduce their energy use, including growing their own food and so forth, and those who regard the American way of life as non-negotiable?
Yeah, but I see it sort of happening on a regional basis, more or less. I do think that the Northeast probably has somewhat better prospects even though it's colder. We do have water, and plenty of it. We have water power. I think that it will tend to see some regions doing better than other regions.
One thing that's interested Colin Campbell and many others of us, he from his point of view of trying to get the message out, and I'm interested in aspects of the media because I've been in it, I've studied it, I've done quite a lot of work on how the media doesn't do a frightfully good job of covering complex issues. And I wondered what you thought. You've been a journalist, a writer for many years. What do you think of the media response as you see it to this oil peak, the hydrocarbon problem, and how much longer do you think it can be hidden?
Well, you know, I tend to be a non-conspiracist. That is, I'm a non-believer that there are great conspiracies going on in the world or the nation, and really for two reasons. One, that it's part of human nature that people just can't keep secrets. You know, they just can't. They're just not very good at it. And the other one is that, by and large, people aren't that smart. They're smart enough, and there are some very smart people, and there are even large numbers of them. But I don't think that there's a conspiracy in the media to hide this issue. I think what we're seeing in the media is really just another example of the diminishing returns of technology. We have more means and greater ability to move information in different ways than we ever had in the history of the world, and almost all of the information that we're moving around is meaningless. The more conduits of information we create, it seems, the more crap and static and nonsense we fill it up with. Here in my house, you know, we have about 60 cable channels, including about 9 cable channels of news. And on those 9 news channels, we've got Larry King talking about Michael Jackson and Britney Spears. And I don't think it's malicious, and I don't think that they're trying to hide anything. I just think that there's a natural tendency for bad news to drive out good news, just as bad money drives out good money when you introduce a lesser form of money into a currency system or a gold system. Gresham's Law applies, and Gresham's Law, unfortunately, applies to culture, too. So we're seeing the diminishing returns of it. The consequence of that is that there's a tremendous amount of noise out there and very little real good information, and certainly even less wisdom, and certainly beyond that, even less motivating information that gets people to act in ways that are intelligent. So that's what I think is going on there.
You mentioned Gresham's Law, and you picked up on currency, and so I would love to ask you, I know you said you're not an expert on these on oil, of course, and currency is one of these complex areas, but could you say something, just because you have a voice which is listened to by many, could you at least say something about why you think people are talking about currency, particularly the euro and the dollar, with regard to oil, and if you have any sort of feelings about that, why it might be significant, what it might mean for the economy, because after all, a lot of what you've been talking about has been oil and economy and effects, in behind the scenes.
Yes. In my view, one of the reasons that we're seeing such anxiety over the American dollar is not just because historically, for a period of time, the sale of petroleum has been pegged to the dollar, but it has to do with the nature of what the American economy is and what the dollar stands for. Currency in our lifetime, of course, it's not pegged to anything concrete like gold that actually holds value, but it really takes the form of a kind of a collective hallucination, which is to say a consensus, an agreement among many, many, many individuals about what constitutes value and what stands behind a given currency. In our case, it has been the idea that the American economy was a fabulous dynamo that produced tremendous wealth, correct? And I think from my point of view, what's happened is that the American economy has actually been hollowed out as we've outsourced and thrown away our manufacturing abilities and capabilities. And really, what the American economy is about now, it's about the creation of suburban sprawl and of its furnishings and accessories. And at some point, you know, there's a recognition, I think, perhaps unconscious among the other nations in the world who observe us, that that isn't good enough. You know, and the consensus is beginning to form that that's not enough to support a strong dollar. In fact, this is a problematical economy and perhaps a weak and precarious economy, and one that is based on the continuing misallocation of resources into a living arrangement based on the future consumption of enormous amounts of fossil fuel that are not going to be there. The Europeans, on the other hand, for all of their historic problems and perhaps the various individual national character deformities or their virtues. One thing you can say about the Europeans and their living arrangement is that they at least are living in towns and cities that have some prospect for utility in the future. They will be able to carry on their life in their cities without the same kind of massive amounts of petroleum that we're using now to run a place like Atlanta or Phoenix or Houston. So I think that, you know, not only is it a matter of the dollar being pegged to the price of oil, it's a matter of what kind of economy really does stand behind the dollar. And I think the view is that possibly we recognize it's a flimsy economy based on things that are not producing much of real value.
And it's just so important to hear people at least linking currency in with this business, I believe, because it's going to become more and more apparent, and it is a ferociously complicated business.
You know, there's one other thing I could add to this. Tied, of course, to the whole extremely precarious condition of the suburban sprawl economy is the enabling mechanism of our out-of-control credit system and all the debt that has been amassed explicitly and overtly in the service of creating all these suburban houses and subdivisions and strip malls and all the stuff that I've been talking about. The nature of that investment is not only have we put our national wealth in this stuff that has no future, but we've also hocked ourselves up to our eyeballs on the creation of more of this stuff that has no future, utility or worth or value. So that actually takes the problem a bit further.
Yes, yes. The last couple of things I would like to ask you, if I may. You've talked a lot about allocation in terms of misallocation of particularly monies and investments and so forth. To come on to a question which is very much on the tips of many people's tongues, but perhaps put in a slightly different way than it often is, do you think that Americans have a right to as much energy as they need, which is a kind of coded way of asking whether the U.S. is entitled to Iraqi, Saudi, Iranian oil?
Well, it ought to be clear from what I've already said that I don't necessarily think that anybody is necessarily entitled to anything. We get what we do in this world sometimes by accident and sometimes by luck and sometimes because we've worked very hard to earn it and sometimes because we've been virtuous and sometimes because we've been wicked. And I suppose that many of those things have worked in combination for America. I tend to think that we've simply been, in some respects, lucky. Our nation is founded on a continent that, up until recently, enjoyed a great deal of protection from lying between two oceans. We were the first people to discover large amounts of oil on our continent and to be able to exploit it successfully. You know, those were kind of lucky things. And we were able to develop, you know, an oil-based economy that seemed to work and produce some technologically miraculous things for a period of about 100 years. And we were fortunate. But, you know, now we're suffering kind of an equal misfortune of having enjoyed all that luck and having been lulled into a false state of security and finding ourselves now sleepwalking into a long emergency. And we're going to find out, I think, that the law of perverse outcomes is correct, that we may not get what we expect, which is to say our entitlements to a drive-in utopia forever. We may instead get what we deserve, which is a long period of turmoil, turbulence, woe, distress, misery, and ultimately the loss of the things we cherish most, our democratic republic and its institutions.
That goes some way to answering the last question, which is around the idea that there are many possible reactions to an understanding that oil peak is going to happen, or indeed is happening. Some people can see in it a certain blessing in disguise. Other people think it's going to be it's just a horror and they can't face it. And then there are some people who are the opposite of the cornucopians, the absolute die-off doomsters. And for them, this is it. This is what they've been predicting all along. And I wondered where you were, bit of blessing in disguise, bit of die-off, neither.
I think that's accurate. You know, the die-off gang has put out a pretty compelling set of arguments. And, you know, one of the things we didn't talk about today, of course, was where microbiology fits in, because you can make some persuasive arguments that where the world is revving up for a combination of events that are going to considerably thin out the population, and I mean specifically a serious mega influenza pandemic, or the thing that is already underway, the AIDS pandemic, which has prospects for becoming much worse over the next 20 years. And very problematical. But that said, I do find myself not in very firmly in the die-off camp. You know, I do think that the human race does have some resilience. And I do think that we have some prospect of going forward and remaining civilized. It occurs to me that we could face a period of darkness. That has happened before, and it's not something that I particularly welcome, but it's a plausible outcome for a while. History happens to occur in cycles. I don't think the human race is ready to throw in the towel. We have the means to do it, but it ain't necessarily going to happen. It's certainly an interesting period of time to live in. Those of us who were born in the hippie period, like myself, you know, may even enjoy the prospect of returning in another incarnation to see things going on a little further. Who knows? I'm really not that much of a new ager, but I'm very curious about what's going to happen, and I wish us the best.
That's a very nice way to end. Thank you very much.
James Howard Kunstler, author of Geography of Nowhere, speaking with Canadian journalist Julian Darley last March. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. And now for the conclusion of the program, with the next installment of our ongoing reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives, by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. Schmidt has been making the case that at the core of professional qualification is an ideological component that reinforces the capitalist social hierarchy. Last week I read from Chapter 4. I've decided to skip Chapter 5 and go on to Chapter 6, titled The Division of Labor. In Chapter 5, Schmidt does a detailed case study of the physics research being done at the University of California, Irvine. The government is the major funder, and the application of the work largely military. Yet scientists go out of their way to present to others, and perhaps also to themselves, the idea that this research is merely for the sake of increasing knowledge. Schmidt, as he does in all chapters, documents his assertions with examples. In the case of Chapter 5, there are long excerpts loaded with scientific jargon that don't lend themselves well to reading aloud. So, Chapter 6 of Disciplined Minds by Jeff Schmidt, The Division of Labor. The jibes usually come in the course of normal conversation. It's a very tricky experiment, and I don't think the preliminary result will hold up for long. But hey, I'm sure that by the time it's retracted, you theorists will have already explained why it just has to be right. The rivalry between experimental and theoretical physicists is often carried on with humor. But the underlying issue of occupational respect is a serious one, and every remark is noted. Anyone who works around physicists quickly realizes that theorists, the people who work with symbols, are more respected within the profession than experimenters, the people who work with things. All theorists, not just an elite group of Einsteins, receive special respect within the field. And so there is a hierarchy of status between the thousands of rank-and-file theorists and the thousands of rank-and-file experimenters who are employed in universities, government laboratories, and industry. As a student, teacher, and observer of physics for the past 25 years, I've often wondered about the source of this disparity in status. Yet I have never been able to find anything within the practice of physics that accounts for it. It's worth noting that many other fields are stratified in the same way. Within economics, linguistics, sociology, and so on, theorists are looked up to more than individuals who collect and analyze data. Similarly, within the humanities, philosophy is more prestigious than other fields. The hierarchy has parallels far back in history. In the Dark Ages, the social status of priests was higher than that of craftsmen. The justifying mythology was that the priests were closer to God. But of course, the widespread belief in this mythology had a material basis, the power of the church. This example suggested what I consider to be the most incisive question that one can ask about the hierarchy of status within physics. What is the material basis for its persistence? Physicists working in the United States number anywhere from 50,000 to 100,000, depending on your definition. Experimenters outnumber theorists 2-to-1. But this ratio is not high enough to make theorists seem at all uncommon within the field or scarce within the job market. Employers put both theorists and experimenters on the same salary scale, and it is often the experimenters who control the biggest research budgets. So money, while definitely a source of status among physicists, does not account for the unequal distribution of respect between theorists and experimenters. What about intellectual freedom? Within any field, the highest status usually goes to those whose work is most independent of views set down by others. Among these individuals are those who help formulate the models that guide the work of others in the field. In physics, these are the researchers who challenge the field's paradigms or who develop new paradigms, that is, new ideologies or ways of viewing the world. These physicists, who are mostly theorists, do indeed enjoy high status within the field. However, only a handful of theorists exercise this kind of intellectual freedom in their work. Most theorists, like most experimenters, merely use the established paradigms. While intellectual freedom distinguishes an elite group of theorists, it does not explain the hierarchy that divides the rank-and-file theorists, who use the paradigms to do their calculations, from the rank-and-file experimenters, who use the paradigms to make their measurements and construct their devices. The work of these theorists and experimenters adheres with great discipline to the accepted views in their field, the paradigms. Rank-and-file scientists are ideological in their work, then, not because they produce ideology like the elite, but because they confine themselves to the given ideology without deviation. This ideological discipline is characteristic of all rank-and-file professionals who, unlike the non-professionals below them in status, are trusted to understand and use the ideology, but who, unlike the elite above them, are not employed to formulate or question the ideology. If this relationship between professionals and the ideology of their fields seems familiar, that is probably because it is the same as the relationships between professionals and the outlook of their employers, discussed at the end of the previous chapter. A relatively small number of physicists go beyond merely using the paradigms and instead work to fine-tune them. Much of today's particle physics research, both theory and experiment, is such middle-range work. This work aims to refine what is known to be the standard model, which is the prevailing theory of the properties and interactions of quarks, electrons, and other elementary particles. Many particle theorists work to extend the standard model to more phenomena, make predictions that test various parts of the theory, and reconcile the theory with experimental findings. At the same time, many particle experimenters search for new phenomena in specific areas where the theory might be extended, work to confirm or contradict parts of the theory, and measure parameters that are needed to do calculations based on the theory. This sort of middle-range work is directed by the paradigm it serves to refine, making it almost as intellectually circumscribed as the work done by the majority of physicists, which merely uses the paradigm. In any case, fine-tuning of paradigms is as likely to be done by experimenters as by theorists, and therefore cannot contribute to the difference in status between the two groups. If neither financial nor intellectual freedom is the material basis for the hierarchy, that divides rank-and-file theorists and experimenters, then what is? What about the importance of the work? A conductor on a train, objecting to the engineer's greater prestige and salary, once asked me rhetorically, "Who is more important in an orchestra, the conductor or someone who plays an instrument?" Many workers, like this train conductor, feel they don't get the respect they deserve. They find that no matter how hard they work, their status in society stays about the same, for it is tied more to the type of work they do than to how well they do it. Hence, from conductors and teachers to nurses and secretaries, workers wanting greater respect or salaries tend to center their arguments on the unrecognized importance of their work. Within physics, however, everyone seems to agree that the field cannot advance without both theoretical and experimental work, and the notion that the work of rank-and-file theorists is more important than that of their colleagues in the lab is only infrequently put forward. Finally, consider intellectual difficulty. Of course, the intellectual difficulty of any job is largely a matter of opinion. Nevertheless, a job's reputed intellectual difficulty is an important source of social status. In a research laboratory, a physicist or even a graduate student has higher social status than a machinist, glassblower, or electronics technician, even though the skilled worker may have a higher salary because of greater seniority. The physicist is simply thought to do the more intellectually difficult work, and by design, the physicist generally does. However, the opposite is frequently true on important components of a project, because it is often intellectually easier to figure out what needs to be done than to actually do it. It may not tax the physicist's mind to say, "An ultra-sensitive picosecond pulse counter would certainly do the job here," or, "Make a large circular flange and find its center to within a half a thousandth of an inch." But designing the needed components, building them, and making them work, which may be the technician's assignment, can involve much more difficult problem-solving. If physicists have higher status than technicians because in most cases their work is genuinely more intellectually difficult, then is there also a genuine imbalance of intellectual difficulty between theory and experiment that accounts for the hierarchy among the physicists themselves? Indeed, the work of the rank-and-file theorist is generally thought to be more intellectually difficult than that of the rank-and-file experimenter. But experimental work, like theoretical work, is mainly intellectual labor, and coming up with a strategy to attack a theoretical problem is not necessarily more intellectually difficult than coming up with a strategy to attack an experimental one. Actually, carrying out the experimental approach involves both intellectual and manual work, just as carrying out the theoretical approach involves both intellectual and clerical work. The clerical work, tedious algebraic manipulations, computer programming and debugging, looking up mathematical relations, and so on, severely limits the pace of the research, and theorists cannot claim to spend a larger fraction of their time on creative work than do experimenters. An advertisement in physics today for computer software that does algebra and other symbolic manipulation invites frustrated theorists to, quote, "imagine having more time to ponder the abstract rather than having to derive the solution." In any case, and this is the problem, the reality doesn't seem to matter much. Even though making nature behave in the laboratory is clearly as intellectually difficult as making models of nature behave on paper, people simply do not associate the former with intelligence to the same extent. Good measurements require as much cleverness as good calculations, but there is a tendency to see them as requiring less. Feeling at home in the physical world, the world of apparatus, is just as much an intellectual achievement as feeling at home in the symbolic world, the world of equations, but people generally consider it a lesser accomplishment. Theorists have higher social status, but not because their work is any more intellectually difficult, but because people perceive it to be. What accounts for this false perception? To most people, theory's greater intellectual difficulty is simply a matter of common sense. What then is the source of this mistaken common sense about work in science? The answer can be found in the structure of work in the larger society, beginning with the separation of mental and manual work, of conception and execution. The division of labor is inherently hierarchical and makes possible a hierarchical system of production in which non-laborers control the products of the work of laborers. I use the term non-laborers here in a very narrow sense to refer specifically to those at the top of hierarchy of production in any of the world's hierarchical economic systems. Non-laborers are those who control the employing institutions, whether through the party, as in communist countries, or through the government, as in socialist countries, or through ownership, as in capitalist countries. The hierarchical system of production looms large in the lives of people throughout society, and every individual is keenly aware of where he or she stands in it. Those who control the employing institutions and who enjoy the right to treat the products of labor as their own have great power both in the workplace and in the larger society, and have higher social status than the laborers. This basic arrangement sets the tone for the culture, which mediates the assignment of status to people throughout the society. In the culture, work gains social status if it resembles in form the activity of those at the top, and loses status if it resembles the work of laborers. Thus, the manipulation of symbols has a higher social status than the manipulation of things. The culture makes a fetish of this hierarchy of mental over manual work, carrying it beyond the immediate needs of the system of production. So if your job requires getting your hands dirty, you automatically have one strike against you as far as social status goes. Whereas, if your job is extremely intellectual, your work is seen as semi-divine, glowing with the radiance of disembodied thought. This explains, finally, the higher social status of rank-and-file theorists over rank-and-file experimenters. These scientists have equal financial and intellectual freedom and do work of equal importance and intellectual difficulty, making them technically equal performers within the hierarchical system of production itself. However, in the fetishizing culture associated with that system of production, the work of the experimenter is tainted by its manual component. As such, it is seen as less intellectually difficult and less deserving of status. Hence, while the dominance of non-laborers over laborers in the larger society is the material basis for the higher social status of rank-and-file theorists over rank-and-file experimenters, it is the companion culture that actually hands the theorists their higher status. This culture is the source of the common sense that the work of theorists is more intellectually difficult than that of experimenters. The ranking of respect within physics comes from outside of physics. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. Continuing with the final subsection of Chapter 6. Weakening the individual. The culprit, the hierarchical division of labor, has another dimension relevant to physics. It leads to extreme specialization. In particle physics, for example, it is not unusual now for several hundred physicists from several dozen institutions to collaborate on a single experiment at an accelerator laboratory. Thus, one routine paper in physics letters reporting results from a standard model experiment at the European Particle Accelerator Laboratory, CERN, has 562 authors from 39 universities and government laboratories. Each institutional group of physicists contributes a component of the experiment. An individual physicist within each group specializes even further. In any case, the typical physicist in the collaboration does work in which no amount of creativity could significantly influence the overall course of the experiment. And with narrow work assignments, individual initiative is more likely to cross boundaries and to be seen as intrusive, even if it makes sense scientifically. The division of labor within research projects is often so hierarchical that the distribution of authority is more like that of the military than that of a democracy. Professors are at the top and are themselves organized in a strict hierarchy. You can usually tell who's at the apex by looking at who is getting publicity, because the professors who have the most power within a physics project usually designate themselves as spokesmen and forbid other professors to speak to the press. Next in line are the research physicists, who are the PhDs whom the professors hire with their federal contract or grant money. Research physicists get professorial wages but do not get tenure or a vote at meetings of their university physics department. Postdocs follow, and graduate students are at the bottom. There is not even a pretense of democracy among these scientists. The professors at the top of the hierarchy have total creative control over the experiment. If a physicist below the top has a real say in what is done, that is not because a democratic structure ensures it, but because an individual at the top happens to be a good boss and allows it. Those who are troubled by such practices within any field should examine the larger society within which the field operates. A critical and somewhat detailed examination of the division of labor outside of physics, for example, is necessary for anyone concerned about the practice of physics. First, this type of examination provides a deeper understanding of the external sources of the hierarchy within physics, and thereby allows one to judge for oneself how amenable to change that source might be. Second, it alerts us to practices to watch out for in physics, for no field is immune to the increasing division of labor and the problems that come with it. While these problems may be most noticeable in large physics projects, they are certainly not confined to big physics. So having traced the higher status of theorists to the hierarchical division of labor outside of physics, let us take a closer look at the role the division of labor plays in work as it is usually organized in the larger society. No matter what the product is, employers divide the work into many parts and assign each employee one type of activity. Narrowly focused individuals can work in a more machine-like way and get more work done per hour. Moreover, people who exercise fewer skills or simpler skills can be paid less. Hence, employers label the division of labor efficient. But it is efficient only if one ignores the social cost of organizing production in a way in which jobs tend to be monotonous and unsatisfying. Such jobs, instead of allowing individuals to develop their mental and physical abilities by exercising them freely and fully, that is, instead of being fun, numb the mind and the body, and retard the personal development of those employed to do them. A system of production that works efficiently toward the goals of employers does not necessarily work efficiently toward the goals of employees or toward the goals of society in general. More important to employers than the economic benefits, however, are the political benefits of the division of labor. Benefits that help management maintain its authority in the workplace, confined to a range of activity that is limited both horizontally and vertically. Employees do not gain first-hand knowledge of the overall organization, strategy, or goals of the institution that employs them. Those who work within this division of labor see the consequent ignorance in themselves and in their coworkers, and feel a need to be directed by people who comprehend the whole operation. Management has the broadest view of what is going on, and this helps make its supreme authority in the workplace seem natural and justified. We should note, however, that even as employees feel the need for managers, they don't actually like being managed. Least accepting of management's authority are those who imagine greater self-management, at least for themselves. When employee resentment of managerial authority becomes sufficiently deep and widespread, the efficient system of production becomes inefficient even from management's selfish point of view, because disaffected employees engage in what amounts to silent personal strikes. Thus, employee absenteeism, sloppy work, hostile attitudes, and so on have forced some companies to ease up on the strict know-your-place division of labor and try systems of production that are more personally empowering and engaging. These systems of greater self-management do require a less rigid division of labor so that employees can gain a broad understanding of the organization they are part of, not through rumors and company newsletters, but through real participation in a wide range of activity at all levels. Discouraging employees from thinking about self-management is not the only political function of the division of labor. By making employees easier to replace, and by deflating their feeling of accomplishment in their work, the division of labor strips workers of their sense of power in the workplace, discouraging them from challenging management on the way the work is organized. And the division of work into narrow tasks, most of which are the same even when the product is different, denies workers a feeling for what they are producing, thereby discouraging them from challenging management on the nature or design of the product or service. Hence, the division of labor, by making self-management seem impossible, and by strengthening management's control over the workforce and over the content of the work, helps make the hierarchical system of production more secure. The historical trend is toward an increasingly fine division of labor and an increasingly strict confinement of individual employees to their assigned areas of work. This trend affects professionals and non-professionals alike, distancing all employees from decision-making on the overarching moral and political issues. Professionals are forced into increasingly narrow specializations during training, and more than ever must specialize even further once on the job, especially when they are employed in large organizations, as is increasingly the case. So even the employees whom management trusts politically to use relatively broad technical and organizational knowledge of the production process find management confining them to work on smaller and smaller pieces of the big picture. No professionals are immune. Even philosophers, who at one time struggled to develop thought that encompassed all of human endeavors, are now hired on the basis of their willingness and ability to carry out the minutely specialized work of analytical philosophy. Consequently, they increasingly identify themselves as masters of the associated specialized tools and methods, rather than as independent moral and political thinkers. Scientists, who are this chapter's main example, and whose specialization is typical of salaried professionals in all fields, should look critically at this division of labor and the problems that come with it. Social hierarchies are sources of social friction, and those in science are no exception. Reducing the division of labor within science, and doing what we can to chip away at the external ones, will help break down social hierarchies in science, and can only help make scientific work more fruitful, more socially beneficial, and more fun. And that was The Division of Labor, Chapter 6 of Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000 by Roman N. Littlefield. And I'd especially like to thank my friend Dave Adelson, also a scientist, for making me aware of this book, which has not gotten the attention that it deserves. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.